This episode was recorded before the events of October 2023.
Hi there, this is Claudia Stevens.
And this is Rima Sharif, presenting to you Progressing Planning, a podcast series on the role of planning in fostering change in contemporary society.
In this episode, we'll be talking with Dr. Muna Dajani. Muna holds a PhD from the Department of Geography and Environment at the London School of Economics. Her research focuses on documenting water struggles in agricultural communities under settler colonialism, in addition to working on issues of environmental justice and green energy colonialism. She has contributed to numerous studies on the hydropolitics of the Jordan and Yarmouk river basins, in addition to publishing on topics related to water history, transboundary water governance, and climate justice. She also co-led a collaboration project documenting the story of the occupation of the Syrian Golan through developing an online knowledge portal featuring collective memories of the popular struggle that took place there.
In today's episode, we'll be talking about the differing geographies of Palestine with a focus on understanding the reasons behind the uneven and inequitable resource management in the area. So, hi Muna, thanks for joining us today.
Hi Reem, hi Claudia, thank you for the invitation.
So most of your work focuses on Palestine, which to many is geopolitically associated with Israel. In shorter conversations that we had, we talked about this idea of problematizing the inherent labeling of Palestine as contested urban space or the entire issue being classified as a conflict. So before we delve into your work, could you clarify a bit about how you frame most of your work on Palestine, considering these different framings of the area?
It's definitely one of those issues that has dominated for decades in the way that Palestine and knowledge about Palestine has been produced, framing what's happening there as a contestation, as a conflict between inherently two equal sides, and kind of reducing what's happening in Palestine to merely just a conflict to be understood from an international relations lens or a geopolitics lens or so on and so forth. So that is in itself highly problematic because the case in Palestine is a case of a settler colonial project, an entity which is Israel, that has caused and has been causing the dispossession of Palestinians for a century now.
Yeah.
Here is what I find really problematic about contestation or about using it as a conflict, which is not. And there is an indigenous population that lives in Palestine versus a settler population that has been moved there throughout the decades through different waves, let's say, to get to where we are today, which is a case where Palestine is a case that we can highly see a settler colonial reality that Palestinians have been living under. And inequality is actually inherent in that settler colonial project between the settlers, those who are settling, and those who have been dispossessed by the settlement project.
Okay. Yeah, and I think establishing that framing and that sort of power relationship is really important for then talking more about your work on inequitable resource management and access throughout Palestine. So kind of keeping that in mind, could you talk a little bit about the governance and provision of infrastructure in Palestine related to resource management and in terms of kind of who owns, who operates this infrastructure and which areas?
Yeah, I think it's really important to highlight, like, this is kind of, let's say there are the latest debates whether, like, you know, Israel is practicing apartheid in Palestine. It's a settler colonial project. That these kind of, all of these discussions and all of the reports that have come out from different international and Palestinian organizations proving and documenting the practices that Israel has been doing in Palestine as practices of apartheid. And at the heart of it, of course, is that, like, the uneven development, the inequitable access to resources like land and water, to also to the uneven development of infrastructure and services. So this all comes under, you know, what makes Israel as what labels Israel as an apartheid state or as a settler colonial project. So basically what we see is same geography with the same resources, but there is a bit of prioritization for a certain group of people to exploit those resources, to extract those resources innovated, while heavy restrictions are implemented on Palestinians who would like to also be developing those resources, managing those resources and accessing them. We have to also understand that Palestine is not geographically limited to the West Bank and Gaza. Both are occupied territories since 1967, but if we want to kind of look at the geography of Palestine, we start in 1948 and speak about Palestine, which was under colonial British mandate, and which in 1948, Palestinians who were living in that land have been dispossessed of their livelihoods, of their towns and villages and cities, and a huge exodus and expulsion of Palestinians happened in 1948, leaving Israel to control most of the land. So with controlling most of the land and the resources, we maybe can see now why is it so reductionist to speak of uneven, you know, access to resources in that kind of binary way of, oh, Palestinians have less than Israelis. It's not only about quantifying those that access to, let's say, water or land, but also, yeah, it's systematic and it is inherent to the settler colonial project. It's not going to go away very easily. It will remain unequal, uneven and unequal. If that project continues in the way it is continuing.
And I know you've talked a bit in your work about sort of the role of that apolitical framing of uneven resource management sort of as something that's passive or inherent. Moving off of that, could you talk a little bit more about the specifics of like these processes that lead to such inequitable resource allocation?
Yeah, and if I can build on that, if you could also tell us if there are restrictions imposed on owning or providing infrastructure, and these restrictions, who are they imposed by and onto whom exactly?
Yeah, so basically there is, yeah, it's multi-layered and there is a historical legacy to unpack here to understand how did we reach to a position today where we speak about inequitable resource management and provision of services. And basically it's because most of those institutions that were established prior to 1948 with the Zionist project were exclusively focused on the development of Israeli settlements that later on became Israeli settlements and Israeli kibbutzim, so collective villages that were also established before 1948. So if we speak about water, for example, we see that Mekarot, which is the Israeli national water company, has its roots in the Zionist project. And we can reflect like with similar to that on land and water and other resources, they all have that kind of ideological legacy and history that continues until this day. So basically those institutions that govern not only Israeli water use, for example, they also govern and limit Palestinian water use. So Mekarot also controls water access in Palestine. You know, the drilling of new wells, if any, in the Palestinian West Bank, how much water Ramallah gets, you know, a lot of contemporary issues of allocation, distribution is still controlled by this Israeli national water company that is that has its roots in the Zionist project, that is a settler colonial project. So you can see here where that does the exclusion lie. It's not only by a certain law or regulation that limits, but it's because of the whole laws and regulations totally exclude Palestinian from their calculation. So not only that Israel proper, which is in the 1948 borders and 1967 borders, when we speak about Israel, we talk about 1967 borders. You know, we have the West Bank and Gaza and then Israel proper. So that area, that Israel proper, in between quotations, is also home to many, more than 20% of that populations are Palestinians.
Yeah.
Are they getting equal access to resources like Israeli settlements? That is also why we label Israel as an Israeli, as an apartheid regime, because Palestinians also that live on that side also don't get equal access to provision. Noting that they don't get equal access to land and resources because their land was taken away from them. So more than 90% of the land is controlled by the state for Israeli Jewish population. They are left to live in very limited areas of land where they're not allowed to expand. Their urban zoning is heavily restricted by Israeli settlement projects happening inside Israel proper. And the fact that, you know, Palestinians, who are usually agrarian communities and societies, don't have access to land, therefore they don't have access to water for agriculture, because their land has been taken away from them. So we have to kind of see also that effect or the impact of those decades of land and water dispossession on existing communities today that cannot really practice their livelihood. They cannot stay on the land like they want to. They cannot grow certain crops and so on. That is, let's say, Palestinians who live inside that area.
Yeah.
Then we talk about Palestinians. So these are the multi-tier geographies where Palestinians are existing, and the limits to which they can access resources becomes less and less. So Palestinians in the West Bank, certain areas in the West Bank, like Area C. Area C hasn't seen any developmental work in terms of infrastructure, because that is considered to be an area that is under full Israeli military and administrative control. So here we see no infrastructure has been developed. The international community as well complies to that restriction and also focuses its development and infrastructural development to other areas of the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So we see here kind of that it is not a clear cut in terms of like who gets access. We have to see it as a whole project. It's one project of settler colonialism, and it's happening in, let's say, different ways across different geographies of fragmentation. That's how I see Palestine. That's how I would like to understand that unequal and inequitable access to resources, provision of resources, development of infrastructure, and management of land, water, and natural resources.
Could you just clarify to our listeners who are a little less familiar with the area what Area C is?
So Area C, so under Oslo Accords, so there has been like a peace negotiations happening between the Palestinian Authority and Israel, of course, with the mediation of international community. There is a Palestinian Authority. It established a Palestinian Authority to be kind of in charge to administer the area of the West Bank since the 1990s. But basically what happened is that the West Bank was divided into three different areas. One that is called Area A, which is a full, between quotations, I say it because, of course, it's very much not a lot of control, but administrative control of that area by the Palestinian Authority. Area B lies in between, where the military and administrative responsibilities lies with the PA and Israel. And the third is Area C, which is basically under Israel's military and administrative controls, meaning that Israel
mm-hmm.
controls that area technically
yeah.
still. However, I would like to note also that for, you know, on the ground, reality on the ground, Israel controls all of the West Bank and still imposes a siege on Gaza. So none of those geographies are geographies where Palestinians have any control of their resources or any sovereignty over development and management of those resources. We are now, of course, witnessing an escalated violence against cities and villages in Palestine at unprecedented rate, even worse than usual. So the Israeli army enters those areas whenever it wants. It destroys infrastructure. It, of course, carries out all sorts of violations against people and land unabated. So there is no difference between those areas. But Area C remains an area that is heavily underdeveloped. And I say that it's an imposed underdevelopment. It's not because it is a rugged terrain. It's not because it's remote. It's because it has been politically constructed to be this way. So there is no infrastructure development there. Communities are at the front line facing the Israeli army, where their grazing lands are categorized as military zones or firing zones, for example, where they face the threat of demolitions on a daily basis of their houses, of their agricultural lands and infrastructures. So this is a daily reality in Area C, but it can also happen in different areas, like I mentioned. That political fragmentation and geographical fragmentation, everybody still suffers from the same kind of exclusion, but on different levels.
Really interesting how lack of access to certain resources just furthers the disadvantaging of certain groups and kind of like propagates the idea that these areas are rugged or backwards. But in fact, it's just because of the lack of equity in resources or access to resources.
Yeah,
I just want to reel us back a little bit on the point of deconstructing the Palestinian geography, because Palestine is often discussed in a bit of a monolithic sense, with most framings revolving around Gaza and the West Bank. But we can see in your work that you emphasize the diversity of these geographies. So could you tell us a little bit about the different areas that have different levels of equity? I think you kind of touched upon that a little bit with your explanation of the areas, but I don't know if there's something you could tell us more about, like Haifa, Nazareth, and any other areas.
Yeah, definitely. So like in my work, I try to kind of go beyond, you know, just framing Palestine as West Bank and Gaza only, and framing water issues, for example, as only as, you know, issues that are being faced in the West Bank and Gaza, like not really thinking beyond that, because of course the geography, the water bodies, the basins that we speak about, they don't really stop at these virtual borders. Mm-hmm. It's part of one geography. So I think it's really important to kind of move always beyond that, challenge that notion that we can speak of water scarcity, for example, in the West Bank, or we can speak about water pollution just happening in Gaza. But we have to think about, okay, how is it happening? What has allowed it to happen? What processes and legacies have resulted in what we see today, in the catastrophes we see today, for example, in the Gaza Strip, where water is not fit for human consumption? We have reached this level of dehumanization of Palestinians living in the besieged Gaza Strip, where, you know, the UN and other organizations have warned, you know, for decades, but they have also, the international community hasn't really intervened to actually address the political reasons behind the dire situation of water in Gaza. Easily, the Gaza Strip could be supported if there isn't a justice-based approach. We can also see Gaza actually recovering from its man-made water crisis, but we don't see that because of the politics. The West Bank is a very rich area in water, but Israel is pumping most of this water out for its for the exclusive development of its settlements and agribusiness projects. So all of these things are connected. I try to always kind of open it up, look at history as well, and kind of understand the historical trajectory of why do we get to this point today. So with that, I was interested in my research to kind of not only look at the West Bank and look at what the water injustice there, but kind of also look at Palestinian communities that live today inside Israel, inside 1948 borders, and kind of also examine how do they actually manage that unequal, that inherent unequal access to resources. So there are communities like in the Galilee that are agrarian communities that want to be on the land, that they don't have access to water networks, they don't have access to drainage infrastructure, and they don't have access to electricity even at some point, at some places. So their agriculture cannot be developed. So they are left behind, basically staying on the land with their mere resources, whatever is available for them, for their own kind of improvised ways of adapting to that man-made restrictions on access to energy, to water. And they find their own way. And this is where like Sumud kind of comes into the work that I do, which is steadfastness. But I don't look at it from a romanticized way of thinking, oh, Palestinians will remain resilient everywhere and in everything they do. But I kind of look at how people navigate, how Sumud would look like in different places, moving them from kind of clear opposition to Israeli policies, but sometimes maybe moving them closer to working towards, you know, finding a representation or like receiving water quotas or getting some sort of water infrastructure to develop their livelihood. So, you know, we try to kind of make that also issue complex. It's not always clear-cut confrontation. There is always something happening in between those everyday practices and tactics that people use to kind of confront unequal access to resources. And I do that as well in the occupied Golan Heights, which is another geographical area that is under military occupation, but has a Syrian population. But they also have a legacy of and decades of finding material realizations and like infrastructure to counter that water scarcity or that water restrictions that has been imposed to them by Israel. So they have also a very, very like commendable and really impressive way of how they have dealt with unequal access to resources, where they built infrastructures at night, they've kind of hid away these infrastructure development. And all of a sudden, in a few weeks, there were like a lot of water infrastructure. I'm talking about these circular tanks in the occupied Golan Heights that people have started building overnight just because they wanted to stay on the land. They didn't want the land to be confiscated by Israel. Because, of course, if you leave your land for a certain amount of time, it will be under the threat of confiscation. Yeah. So you see that this is where kind of Palestine is and occupied Golan Heights are cases that resemble a lot of cases, let's say, in what's called the Global South. But then there is another layer, I think, which is the ideological dispossession that's inherent in the character of the Israeli state.
So would you say that these initiatives of like space reclamation are organized grassroots initiatives, or are they more like individual and dispersed efforts?
Looking at the Palestinian case and also at the Syrian case in the occupied Golan Heights, I think both are cases of communities, first community, which is the Palestinians, that is stateless, that have never had a governing structure of like a state and government, ministries and all of that. So Palestine has a long legacy of community-led resource management.
Mm-hmm.
There were a lot of community-led mobilizations to protect water, to govern water. So communities have used that for generations to, let's say, equally distribute water amongst the village members or farmers, or much more than that, to kind of also develop agricultural projects. The occupied Golan Heights has a similar vein. Although they were governed by the Syrian government, they were also had their own kind of sovereignty and self-sufficiency, where they have also developed their resources in their own way and on a grassroots level. So, of course, this has changed completely since the Oslo Accords. And this is where we see kind of the shift happening, regression actually happening in terms of community-led resource management. Then we had the Oslo Accords, the peace-building process that kind of really weakened a lot of those initiatives and movements and organizations. They've moved into a more managerial, development-oriented entities and NGOs that kind of cater to international agenda in addition to kind of the PA agenda, and kind of really moving us further away. Like we see also, again, in other cases around the world where development has had a reverse effect. Instead of bringing around prosperity and sovereignty, food sovereignty and water justice and all of that, it actually made things worse. So this is what we see in Palestine as well. So I think this is where we kind of see that, yes, Palestine and the Golan Heights, of course, offer a lot of great examples of community-led movement, but they are changing and evolving. And I think today, in light of the really very, very horrific developments in terms of what's been happening to Palestine and Palestinians in the last years, people are coming back to the land, they are reconnecting with their natural resources, they're understanding, even in the arts, humanities, water, land is not only a topic that engineers and, let's say, urban developers and architects are interested in. Now we see that different sections of society are getting interested in how these resources are governed, what is the inherent politics and power asymmetries that lie in the way we get our water to Ramallah, for example. When we open the tap, why doesn't water get there and not somewhere else? Why are farmers in the Jordan Valley facing, they have not enough water for them to drink, let alone their cattle or their grazing, their agriculture is deemed impossible to carry out. So people are starting to carry out a lot of very impressive projects on the ground to kind of counter that man-made kind of an imposed scarcity / inequality. Like, we don't take it as given, and we don't accept that, oh, it's the way it is, we have less water or we have less land, or climate change is something that needs to be addressed, on a managerial level or through these big organizations and through the government. We can take things and matters into our own hands and create local solutions and appropriate solutions to our realities.
Yeah, we were just looking at some resources that Reem had pulled up, saying that Ramallah has more rainfall than London does annually, which is, a really huge statistic, considering that, they're having issues having enough access to water because it's such a constructed problem there.
I think it just makes us think that, water is not just how much rainfall falls on one geographical area, which for a long time, the way we kind of get taught about the water cycle in school is just like, oh, then water falls from the clouds and snow melts and, all of these things, which is, I think, why a political ecology perspective, offers much more than just understanding, let's say, geographical and environmental conditions, but also kind of always linking them to issues of inequality, power asymmetry, and kind of really opening it up. And this is where kind of that critical political ecology approach brings in a lot of critical insights, let's say, into our understanding of the world and our understanding of our geographies. And so, yeah, an eruption of a volcano or an earthquake, flooding, erosion, all of those things, then we start thinking of them in a very different light. It's not just a natural phenomena that man comes in, usually man, a masculine approach is men come in, engineers, scientists come in to solve a problem with nature to help humanity.
Yeah.
While we never really understand, like, okay, these are all part, they're one actor in a chain of many other actors, and we have to understand, you know, the power asymmetries that lie within those structures. So,
yeah, really interesting that you brought in the idea of like technological solutionism and how reductionist that can be, and then also climate resilience and how naturally Palestinian communities would be the communities most affected by climate change, considering the lack of access to infrastructure or resource management. Yeah, so I think that could like tie us into our next section, which is on methodology.
Yeah, so I mean, especially while you're talking about all the different geographies and sort of understanding the power asymmetries, and specifically sort of what these communities are doing to adapt to all of these issues, naturally, that's not not a very simple research, you know, region to navigate. So could you tell us a bit more about sort of the methodological standpoints of your research and kind of how you navigate these situations? What are some challenges that you've had to face and overcome?
Yeah, I think it would be nice to kind of speak about my work at LSE as just a researcher before I did my PhD. And then we had this a big project by the Middle East Center that looks at human security and looking at climate change as kind of understanding what are the perceptions about climatic changes in agrarian societies under occupation or post-occupation situations. So it was the occupied Golan Heights. We had South Lebanon that was an occupied area also by Israel, that still is occupied until today, and Palestine as well, of course. So I think one thing is that once we have we went to do field work in those communities, for me, my approach has been to spend as much time as possible to understand, you know, the realities of living under occupation for the Syrians, let's say, in the occupied Golan Heights. A very similar experience, but of course somehow different from that of Palestinians. And it was really fascinating to spend time, do field work, carry out ethnographic research, look at alternative sources, for example, instead of just looking at, you know, government reports or literature that has been published, let's say, in English or in Western sources and journals. Kind of also look for village books, for example. These were kind of a very popular means of documentation and archiving by Palestinians and also Syrians, which basically allows people from the community to document the history of their villages, you know, the land, the zoning and urban planning in their village, how they saw it, how they have been managing it. You know, the changes that happened over time, especially, of course, in 1948, but beyond that as well. So a lot of villages in the Galilee, Palestinian villages and towns would produce those village books, for example. Also, refugees who are living in refugee camps will also document, you know, their memory of their places, who was living where, how was the land, you know, used and regulated, where were the agrarian or agricultural areas, sorry, and how, what type of fruits, what type of crops did they grow, and so on and so forth. So I think when I did my research in the occupied Golan Heights, I tried to follow that same approach and try to understand from local sources, from local memories of the place and of their relationship with water, land, and so on. So it was really interesting because that first research, people were saying like, oh, it's not climate change we kind of fear, but we also are, we know that we live under unequal access to resources. That for us is much more restrictive than climate change. At least they see it this way. They say there is traditional knowledge and generational knowledge to kind of cope with climatic changes. Not, of course, to those unprecedented we see today, but still, there is knowledge that people are trying to preserve from generation to the next regarding crop selection, regarding how to deal with drought and some year. Like, there are a lot of practices. Some of them are still alive. Some of them have been really restricted under, you know, the conditions we live under. But But that was really interesting as well to highlight. So I think one thing is that I've learned, and I continue now to carry on with my research, is to look at water from an ethnographic point of view. So kind of really embed myself in my research and my positionality as a Palestinian researcher, you know, to use our local knowledge to understand, you know, the issues that we face, instead of kind of a top-down approach where we use theory to kind of explain things to us. I think bottom-down approach also offers such a rich understanding of those issues. And I think also, yeah, engaging with other disciplines, this is what the beauty of political ecology and critical political ecology is, that engages with humanities, with art and literature, and so many other methods, visual methods of producing research, like visual, audio. So we have really, in terms of method, used a lot of those as well to document different aspects of the research.
Yeah, I think that agency aspect that you brought up is also so important, because naturally sort of your identity as being Palestinian is so crucial to being able to kind of really explore that, you know, that local, like, collective memory almost, and have that trust and that ability to approach things from such a bottom-up way.
Definitely. And I think one at some point, it was really interesting being a PhD student at LSE, then also working at the Middle East Center and as a researcher, is that sometimes different disciplines also look at your research, like your embeddedness in the field and your positionality, as something to question basically your credible, balanced view of what goes on in those geographies. And I think this is kind of still, you know, something that we need to work on. Like, there's still a lot of work to be done to address those issues where a lot of researchers still, a lot of departments and a lot of disciplines still think of a neutrality of knowledge production, you know, where, yeah, you can actually maybe study a whole region or a whole continent just by using data sets and, you know, coming out from a quantifiable way, like just using quantitative approach to understand things. And it, of course, it's never truly neutral, and there's always questions of positionality that the research has to address. So yeah, like, it's still a challenge to also bring forth the knowledge we produce through different research I've been involved in a way to kind of to challenge perceptions about what type of research we're doing and our approach and you know, the validity of what we do and what we produce.
And just in terms of access to these archives, I do understand that that's kind of really important to fight against the cultural erasure or the erasure of Palestinian identities. Is this material that you've collected accessible or widely distributed, just for our listeners that are interested?
Yeah, it's been really, like, there's been a bit of a tectonic shift, as they say, like, because for a long time it depended on the researchers being really embedded in the field to get access to certain resources, especially if you speak about, you know, like, government archives. They're, like, very heavily restricted, somehow securitized. Now, for example, you cannot really, the Israeli archives are off limits somehow, mm-hmm, to most researchers after an opening point where they were accessible for a while. But then, I mean, also that those local community archives, there used to be also a time where you needed to be in the field, you needed to know the language, you needed to, like, be very familiar with the geography and have access to that geography, because at the end we are also privileged in a way to have access to Palestine. I know that a lot of Palestinian and other researchers who are, you know, refugees cannot even come back to Palestine. So what's happening, I wanted to say, is that there's now a lot of online platforms that bring a lot of archives to the wider public, whether it's maps, you know, there's a few projects that do a lot of critical mapping or, like, counter cartography, where basically they show, for instance, map of Palestine with all the villages and towns that existed, the depopulated villages and the expelled, where the population actually traveled. So people are using technology and different softwares to kind of document. And there's a lot of memorization projects happening in Lebanon and other places that are available online. So I think this online trend is actually for the benefit of many researchers and many topics where people have access. In our project at the LSE Middle Center, which is about documenting the occupation of the Syrian Golan Heights, we are developing a platform where we have collected a lot of archival materials with the community, together with the community, and about the Golan Heights in general, that will be available online. We are trying to develop those in both Arabic and English, so that people who cannot reach the occupied Golan Heights, who are interested to learn more about it. So we're trying to develop those type of platforms where knowledge is easily accessible, that people can actually use and engage with and develop. And the whole idea is that knowledge is not one thing. It's just like we need to offer more tools so that people will have access to that same knowledge and develop it in the way they see fit and the way that they want to.
I think also sort of transitioning into this idea of where do we go from here? The idea of accessibility of resources, you know, very much in a knowledge sense way that you've talked about, like not only what you found, for example, what you were just talking about, having, people in both Arabic and English within the Golan Heights, out of the Golan Heights, having access to those documents, as well as sort of that collective memory of land practices and resource management and planning practices that you've talked about, really kind of set a good foundation for trying to move forward from here. What else would you offer as where should we go from here? What comes next? You know, how do we continue to build up these communities? And yeah, sorry, I know that's a huge question, obviously, but yeah, I'm just interested in what you think kind of moving forward from having that accessibility will look like.
Yeah, I think it comes with its own limitations as well, and its own, because now, as you know, like there's a big trend of like decolonizing knowledge production and decolonizing the academy, where you know we're thinking of ways where we can actually produce knowledge in a non-extractive way, because I think a lot of the work we do at the end is extracting even that experiences and the lived everyday experiences of communities, and bringing it to the academic world for debating, for developing, for creating that, you know, knowledge. But I think we need to continue to kind of question our positionality. Where are we coming from? What are we bringing back to those communities, and how are we working together with them? I think COVID also was a critical time for researchers, because researchers started thinking, oh, like, I don't have access to the field. What does that actually mean? Like, what are the power asymmetries there, where if the researcher doesn't have access, how are you relying on the people you work with in those communities? Are they getting more of the load of doing the work for you? Are they as co-authors or co-producers of knowledge together with you? So a lot of these questions started coming up in a project I was involved in at Lancaster University, where like under COVID, you know, you cannot really do field work. How do you navigate that? What do you understand about, oh, well, there is a power asymmetry in even the way we do field work? So a lot of questions that we need to kind of keep asking ourselves, kind of also thinking how our knowledge production can be non-extractivist, can be more justice-based, and can be, you know, meaningful, not just individually for us or for our department or elsewhere, but just in general, because these are ongoing struggles that people are enduring and witnessing and dealing with every day. So at the end, making sure that we are entering on a more equal basis with those communities, working together with them, making sure that the knowledge we produce is knowledge that we have talked with them about and kind of discussed with them. So it takes a lot of labor, a lot of care as well. So all of these approaches are really critical if we want to really move forward in a more equal way and in a decolonial way. So we don't want to be replicating modes of dispossession and exploitation as well, especially because the topics we deal with and we work on in like international development or addressing poverty, global poverty, or unequal urban development, we really need to be very careful about how do we understand the topic and how do we actually produce knowledge about it. And I think this is really not only, of course, Palestine, but anywhere else around the world, because inequality actually replicates across the globe, especially in the global south, in very similar ways. There's a similar pattern of exclusion and extractivism that communities, marginalized communities, communities of color, indigenous people, are witnessing and experiencing. So it's intersectional, basically. Yeah, we have to understand all of those layers of dispossession that we have there.
And just to kind of wrap up, we've touched on so many things, and we're just kind of wondering whether there are any concluding remarks or something that we haven't really spoken about that you would like to address before we wrap up our episode.
Maybe just bringing it back to the start. I don't know, something a bit more positive.
Yeah. Maybe we can talk about the importance of preserving identity or the intersectionality of struggles between people of color and different marginalized communities and the Palestinian struggle, how liberation comes collectively and cannot be pursued in silos or individually.
Yeah, I would add to that is like that, I think for me, it's really important also as researchers that have kind of that passion and that urge and that kind of drive to or like achieve justice in our lifetime through like in different communities or in different struggles is to make sure to also pay attention to the inherent, like, you know, the very silent and subversive type of violence inflicted on us through the way urban development is designed and implemented, the way the infrastructure around us is built, operated, and how does that infrastructure, who was it built for, how does it operate, what is the afterlife of that infrastructure, how does it remain, and how does it affect communities throughout decades, you know. So I think it's really important in our field to kind of really pay attention to those very subtle connections and pipes and towers and whatever it is that you study, you know, if it's electricity, energy generation, if it's climate change policy making, if it's, you know, water and sewage development, urban inequalities, poverty. I think it's really important that we pay attention not only to the things that have been kind of studied, but also kind of to look underground, overground, you know, to kind of to expand, you know, our understanding of those topics, both materially and also epistemologically, so in the way we think about them. So I think that's really important because, yeah, we're facing a very critical time today where, like, there's a lot of inequalities in the way, even, like, I don't know how to say it, but it's just really a critical time to think about, you know, knowledge production. And we see our academies becoming more and more privatized, more and more kind of profit driven rather than really seeking, you know, to better the world, to better our societies. So I think, yeah, it's our role. We have a role to play. We are part of those academies and those universities. So we need to make sure that our role is critical there as well.
Yeah, for sure.
I mean, and it kind of, you know, the takeaways from a lot of conversations like this are the power of, you know, the power asymmetries that lie in, you know, both those academic knowledge producing institutions as well as, you know, those planning institutions that we also talked about. I mean, I think that's really like such a big takeaway here for something that, you know, you can apply intersectionally, as you said.
Like, we see that what's happening, like with the strike and with everything that's going on, how our world is somehow becoming more and more so extractivist in every sense of the word. And yeah, as much as you want to kind of get away from it, that was one way to kind of leave it all. But then if you want to also make any change, maybe you have to do it from within somehow.
Yeah. And as someone also from the Arab world, coming here and pursuing an education on an international level is really important. But also then it's important to contextualize the kind of urban planning practices, for example, on more of a global South context and see what is actually relevant, what is actually applicable, and kind of unlearn different inferiority complexes.
Sure, definitely.
Yeah.
No, it's something that we, like, it's nice, well, it's nice, I don't know if it's nice, but it's important to be in that position where, what I always felt as well is when we joined those international departments that talk about international development and how can it happen and how can we actually eradicate poverty and all of that, and your experience is not really taken into account, although you are there, you are a wealth of knowledge in your own experience, in your intergenerational experience. But I think this is one way where I also felt I kind of exposed that kind of hypocrisy.
Yeah.
Is when we are like sharing our own experiences of of witnessing and experimenting that developmental practices in our own context, that is not taken into account. And this is where kind of the drive comes back very strongly to kind of do things differently.
Yeah.
And challenge all the time, even preconceived notions and ideas. As you said, there's a lot of unlearning to be done, but that unlearning also should be done by the academy itself, you know, and by the departments themselves as well, because you cannot teach international development like we did 20 years ago. So that is really something very, very important.
Thank you so much, Mona.
Thank you both. Thank you for the conversation. It was really nice and very well structured.
Thank you so much again. We really appreciate you being here and having this conversation with us and, you know, offering us such insight and nuance and important perspective. And thank you to everyone listening to this episode as well. For more information, you can visit our blog at this address, www.blog.lse.ac.uk/progressingplanning. Thanks so much, everybody.
Thank you.